This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hello everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 417 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week we are so excited to welcome to the show Mr. Justin Chancellor, who you likely know from his time with Tool, and he's got a new album with his project MT Void, Matters Not, Part 1. It's out November 10th, but there's a super crazy limited vinyl pressing. Not sure if they're still available, but if they are, grab one at globalorning.com. I'll put the link in this episode page to make it easy. It's a pretty eclectic album, very captivating, and I reckon fans of Tool and Justin's work will enjoy. You can even hear a couple tracks on streaming services right now. Just search up MT Void and enjoy. Oh yeah, and just a quick note, there's a special vinyl run, very limited, at Revolver and Brooklyn Vegan. But of course, you can go straight to the source at globalorning.com. Now, today we talked to Justin all about the MT Void project and the Matters Not Part 1 album, as well as we cover some Tool music stories and factoids, the songwriting process, how Justin joined Tool, the Easter egg in 10,000 Days, and of course, where is that Tool vinyl? Plus, there's an extended version of this interview with Justin only for show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. For the supporters of our show, they always know we put extra stuff up on Patreon just for them. We put commercial-free episodes. All interviews are shared up there in very high-resolution files, pleasing to the ears of the audiophiles. And sometimes we even do giveaways, special deals, and whatnot. Now, today, there's an extra 10 minutes or so of our conversation with Justin, and that's only available to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Feel free to go up there, sign up, help support the show, and enjoy all the extras. And finally, there are some additional episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast that I think Tool fans will enjoy. Now, I count myself amongst your ranks, and I'm very happy to share some related interviews you might get a kick out of, including episode 330 with designer Mackie Osborne, bringing to us the story of the creation, secrecy, and manufacturing of Tool's Fear Inoculum Deluxe Vinyl Box Set. That's episode 330 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 368 with Scotty Kirkland of The Crystal Method. Comedian, actor, and podcast pioneer Mark Maron joined us for episode 400. Harry Farrell and Eric Avery of Jane's Addiction, episode 387. Jason Bonham talks about his father and playing with Led Zeppelin, episode 383. Sven Bierge of Royskop discussing electronic music and making album covers with Banksy, episode 364. And literally hundreds of additional episodes and interviews. Just follow the Vinyl Guide podcast for free in any podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. And with that, let's get into our conversation with Justin Chancellor of MT Void and Tool. All right. Well, this week on The Vinyl Guide, ladies and gentlemen, we have with us Justin Chancellor of MT Void. And of course, you probably know him from Tool as well. And he's here to talk records and MT Void, Matters Not, and more. How are you today, Justin?
Doing great. Doing great. Enjoying a nice cool day in California, actually.
All right. Well, that must be a nice change.
It is. It's great. That's great.
So, wait, MT Void, the new album's out November 10th, Matters Not Part 1. So I'm assuming that's correct. A bit of a nod to, not to get it too far ahead of ourselves, but there's potential other parts coming?
Yeah, that was the idea, to kind of like put ourselves under a bit of pressure. We have to do a second part. If you call it Part 1, you got to bring out a Part 2. So yeah, but we've already started working on that. We have a lot of material that we didn't use, obviously, for this album. It's not that long, but it's about 35 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. So rather than put it all onto, you know, a huge long album, we decided to split it into two. And we're, you know, we got plenty to work on for the second one.
With MT Void, you know, this is a very different recording process than you have with Tool and any other projects. Yeah. How does this differ, like, constructively in terms of, you know, how a song from MT Void comes together?
Well, it's a little more, I would say it's a little more train of thought. You know, we did this whole album remotely, It was actually done a little while ago. It's taken us a while, ironically, talking to you to get the vinyl all done and ready to get out. But we were, he was in Poland, Peter, and I was here in California. And what we'll do is he'll create a kind of, I guess you would say, like a drum set, but with noises that he creates himself. And then, you know, he'll add in some kick drums and snare drums and stuff. And then he's very much into making beats and sequences that he'll send me a raw beat. And then I'll basically, you know, sit with it. It's kind of interesting because in Tool, we're all in the room together, kind of throwing stuff at each other and breathing over each other's shoulders. And in this situation, I just receive the beat, sit there in my studio on my own, and kind of just react to it, basically, you know, with no one else around. And I'd like bring out a couple of basses and I'll just hammer away for a few days and record many different bass lines. Just immediately what I feel or what comes to mind, what comes to my hands. And then I'll send that back to Peter. And it's an exciting process because we're basically both excited to hear what's coming from the other. And within a few days, he'll have taken my contribution. And, you know, he likes to call himself a bit of a noise, yeah, a noise myth, you know. So he'll like just crush stuff and stretch it and change the sound a lot, which is fine by me because it takes it into a whole other realm that, you know, I wouldn't normally do myself. So he'll take that, those bass lines, and he'll kind of come up with something that chop them together, really, take pieces that he likes and then send that back to me. And then I'll either, like, you know, dig it or have some reactions to it, want to change something. But it's kind of a fast moving process. And he works pretty quick. I'll get something back within maybe 48 hours. So it's exciting too to send something and then have this embellishment come back. And then, you know, I'll put guitar on it. Once we've got a structure that we like, which is comes pretty quick, I'll maybe record some guitar or add some cymbals here, and I'll send that back to him. And again, he'll do a lot of like EQing and stuff to the sounds that I send him and kind of arrange it with his beat. Until we've got a piece that is like musical and interesting. And then he'll finally, you know, the last thing, he'll put some vocals to it, reacting to it. You know?
It seems like some of your collaborations tend to be with electronic musicians. Scotty Kirkland is a friend of the show. He and I are both synth nerds. Okay. So, you know, You seem to collaborate with these guys who are lovingly electronic introverts. You know, they enjoy the darkened studios full of synthesizers. Is that kind of your lane as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very much into electronic music. I mean, I've always been a fan. I Orb, Underworld, Crystal Method, Chemical Brothers. I mean, I love the, you know, it's something that you don't really get in rock music. I mean, it's improved over the years with the better equipment to capture the low end. But in some of that electronic music, it's just this serious, deep, pure tone, you know, that you can achieve because it's so clean. You know, it's synthesized out of, you know, electronic gear. It doesn't have all the fluctuations that organic instruments have. So you can achieve this real purity of sound, I think, that I mean, I'd love nothing better than just blasting some banging techno, you know, my studio, really, really like making, watching the speakers move. I find something pretty thrilling about that. So I met Scotty on the big day out in Australia a long time ago, just in the line for the bar at a party, and we just became instant friends. And obviously I knew about his music. It turns out he was into some rock music as well. He's collaborated with quite a few rock musicians over his years. So naturally we just, you know, becoming good friends, we ended up trying to do some music together because we liked hanging out anyway. So I guess he, you know, he allowed me to come into his dark place and dabble.
Now you've obviously talked about your love of sound and the purity of the sound, and with Empty Void coming out on vinyl, are you a bit of a vinyl guy? Do you have a record collection?
I have a decent record collection. I actually we're releasing Empty Void on my label. It's Lobel Awning, and this actually is it's a website I have for my side projects, for all the things that aren't Tool, you know. But it actually came from a record and bookstore that I owned with my wife, I think back in 2007. Very small little kind of mum and pop store. But I experimented with collecting a bit of vinyl. I mean, we did mostly CDs. And unfortunately, it was right when the iPod was kind of like bursting onto the scene. It was totally the wrong time to start a record store. But I have a decent, you know, collection, you know, from stuff that I got for that. I collect a lot of Jimi Hendrix stuff. I'm a big Jimi Hendrix fan. So I have a load of those weird albums, of sort of bootleg albums or weird collaborations he did. Anything I can ever find of that, I grab. And yeah, I probably got, my brother's also works for record labels. So he's always sending me stuff. I did a lot of, pushing of the electronic side of stuff in our record store. So I had all that on vinyl, you know, they always put the stuff out of vinyl. So yeah, you know, I wouldn't say I'm an avid collector, but I have a decent amount of vinyl. I've got a couple of turntables up in the house, and I love to just kind of get lost. My wife likes to put it in alphabetical order, and I like to mess it up, you know, because I like the idea that you kind of stumble on things that you've forgotten you had, you know. And that's fantastic with vinyl, because you can look at it and enjoy it as well, you know.
Yeah, I try to alphabetize as well, but then I get those questions like, okay, do I put Parliament and Funkadelic together, you know?
Oh, I know. It gets really, really confusing. Yeah.
Are there any record shops in LA? Do you spend much time in record stores? Or
when we were doing the when we were setting up our store, I went to quite a few of those vinyl kind of fairs where they're you know, exchanging records, and the swap meets. You can always find cool stuff there. I remember going to the Rose Bowl, finding a record that I liked, picking it up, and it just literally melted in my hand. You know, like the old outdoor LA swap meets aren't too good for vinyl. But yeah, on tour, I'll go out and if there's a record store in the local town I'm in, I'll always go, and like, I just like being in record stores, you know. It's always interesting to just see what they got going there.
Yeah.
And also see if they got your own stuff in there. That's always fun.
Well, I always think, like, whenever I go to a new city, I try to find the record shops, because not only do I like records, but they're always in the best neighborhoods. They got like the right, best coffee places, the best places to get a taco. You know, it's always around the record shops.
Yeah. And like really nice people, you know, it's always like, there's always a possibility of a good chat in places like that. So
okay.
And just good vibes, posters, memorabilia, you know, it's always like a lot to look at. There's a lot of art going on in a vinyl shop, so you know, I appreciate all of that.
Okay.
And so we have Amoeba here. I haven't been to the new Amoeba, but I used to go to the Sunset Amoeba quite a bit.
So okay, you're a vinyl fan, vinyl collector, appreciate record shops, especially when they sell the product. Let me just ask, on behalf of music fans around the world, what the fuck is happening with Tool vinyl?
What do you mean?
there's Fear Inoculum, but the entire catalog, Lateralis, 10,000 Days.
It'll come. It'll come. I mean, we're doing all kinds of reissues at the moment, from you know, stuff with CD packages with special re-releases, 20-year anniversary of, or it's past it now, but of Opiate. But yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to bring out everything on vinyl. It's just, you know, everything in Tool takes a long time.
Apparently so. I know.
I mean, if you saw you got the Fear Inoculum big box set. Have you seen that?
Yeah. Oh, it's gorgeous. I love the packaging of it. And I know that Tool always wants to kind of push and do something new and unique. And that's fantastic. But there's coffee cups, beach towels, for God's sake.
Oh.
But no vinyl.
Yeah, it'll come. Be patient.
As
with everything.
I hope I live that long. You know, there's a lot of Tool merch, you know, poster. We talk a lot about collectibles here, and each Tool show has a poster. Yeah. Are you or the band aware of the large trading communities for Tool posters and artwork and merchandise?
We'll be back after these messages. There's no doubt about it. Record collecting has become a serious hobby and even an investment for many around the world. So record collectors have to ask themselves how best to protect their prized records and confidently buy and sell with others. There is an option to consider. Vintage media grading at VMGVinyl.com. VMGVinyl.com will professionally grade your record and encase it in protective plastic, so your record will retain its value for decades to come. This is the same approach that comic book and sports card collectors have done for years. Now, I know many record collectors will be horrified with the thought of having their records graded and encased in plastic. And for the majority of records, this isn't necessary. But if you have top dollar records that you need to protect, maybe a super rare album that's languishing on the shelf, a one-off misprint, or a special LP that you want to protect, look up VMGVinyl.com, Vintage Media Grading, and see if this service is right for you. That's Vintage Media Grading, VMGVinyl.com.
Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. You know, there's a lot of tool merch. Each tool show has a poster. Yeah. Are you or the band aware of the large trading communities for tool posters and artwork and merchandise?
Well, not too much. I mean, I know that once they get bought, they go up in price and they get resold again, pretty much like everything. But no, what do you mean by that?
Oh, well, there's just tool communities that trade all the different posters, and each gig has some unique artwork. Sometimes it's Alex Gray, sometimes it's other artists and those sort of things.
Oh, so they're just trying to collect the kind of the set of stuff. Is that what you mean?
There's some collectors that try to get a poster from every show, or at least shows in their state. Everyone kind of has a different kind of view of the collection. But
I didn't know it was that.
There's tremendous trading communities. There's in the US, there's Tool Loot in Australia, there's Down Undertow. You know, every country seems to have their own kind of spin on the tool collectibles.
Well, yeah, I wasn't that aware of that, but I do. You know, we've just been doing the posters for our next few legs, and it's really fun doing them, like collaborating with other artists, having something different out for every show. I mean, I was a big fan of Rick Griffin and the 60s poster art. I love all that stuff. It was just so beautiful and like experimental, you know, and to combine that with the music and the show and just it's excellent.
Yeah. Do you get to see all the artwork like well before the shows, or do you just show up at a show and like, oh, here's what tonight's artwork is?
No. Well, we're doing it now. Everybody's involved with choosing artists that we like, and then we'll see if they're into contributing something or licensing some art for a poster. And there's plenty of artists that are backing what we do as well, you know, that like what we do. So they're happy to collaborate. And we'll do it a long time in advance. I mean, we're already looking at we're doing a second leg of, we're about to start the tour, but then we're going again in January. So we're trying, obviously it takes a bit of setting up. Mm-hmm. We're getting together more and more artwork for those posters just to keep it interesting, you know, and it's special for everybody on that night as well. You know, to commemorate that specific night.
Yeah.
Specific. Oh, so
each night is like a reveal. So, you know, online you'll see someone say, oh, here's, you know, Indianapolis is tonight. Here is the poster, you know, and everyone's, oh my God, see if you could get me what, you know, it becomes a bit of a, you know, but the community by and large kind of supports each other. If someone is dying for one poster, another person will find it for them.
Well, that's nice. Yeah, I thought you meant it was kind of, you know, like a black market kind of situation.
Well, that,
I mean,
oh, that, as that's clearly happens too. But then there are some benevolent souls that look after others.
I mean, I notice all the, you know, when we do the shows, there's always like, it's very evident. There's people in the front rows clutching their little rolled up white poster, you know, which is great. So they go, you know, they go pretty quick, I think. And they're pretty sought after. So because that's that for that night, you know.
Absolutely. Now, when Tool was in Australia just before the pandemic kicked in, I live in Australia. I live in Sydney. And I took my 10-year-old son to go see Tool. I think it's the February 19th show. I remember it because I have the poster, ironically enough. At the intermission, some of the Tool road crew came out, sought out my son, and gave him Tool picks. And one of them, I think, was from you. And I shared that story online, and several other people said, you know what? This exact same thing happens during intermission. The Tool crew goes out there, and for young people, they kind of give them a little tchotchke of some sort.
Yeah, I mean, we'll do that ourselves. So we'll see a kid in the front row or something and tell your tech, go and sort that guy out, you know, give him a drumstick or, you know, because you tend to, you can throw stuff out, but there's big old hands grabbing everything. So we encourage them to try and sort the younger audience out. Something, you know, they always appreciate it a lot more as well, you know, something special at a show. Whoa, they gave me a pick, you know.
Oh, it's absolutely lovely. And I thought maybe that was a one-off thing, but that seems to be something that happens every show. You're looking after the young'uns.
Yeah, and we, you know, when it comes to Danny as well, we've had a few incidents where, you know, we're sort of encouraging him not to throw his sticks out so often, because it's, you know, occasionally you can hit someone in the eye or it causes a whole lot of trouble. So, well, you know, maybe choose who you want to give them to and send them out with the road crew.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, again, I try to see the band whenever I can, and changes in the set list always seem to be very seismic. You know, again, they just, you know, the whole Tool community, like, oh my God, they played Tempest tonight for the first time. How much in advance does the band plan those reveals or those deep cuts?
Pretty far in advance. I mean, we've got a tour coming up, and we'll pick and choose what we want to do, but we coordinate very much with Maynard and how he's feeling, with how his voice is doing, and try and plan out a set where we can have a few spots where we can switch stuff out. So we'll have a pool of songs, and obviously look at the sets we've done before in those towns that we're going to, and try not to, or not, you know, it's hard not to repeat certain things, but try and mix it up and not do the exact same show in those places. And obviously if we're playing two, I think in Sydney we did two nights maybe last time, I'm not sure, but we'll try and make those a little bit different, you know, because there are people that want to come both nights. And also we want to be on our game. So we like to have a good run up of playing, rehearsing the songs that we're actually going to do on the tour. So yeah, we choose it pretty far in advance.
Now with MT Void, do you see any live gigs coming up with MT Void?
Well, it's a little tough at the moment because Peter's all the way out in Poland. We haven't, you know, he was here maybe 10 years ago for a little bit and hasn't been able to get back so far. So we talked about it last year. I was in Europe doing a tour and had this fantasy of maybe doing a record release party, but it was just too much to get together on the fly. Being that we've never actually played these songs live together, they're being constructed in the studio, you know, from other sides of the world. So we do plan on doing that. I just can't, you know, there's no way of saying when that'll happen. So for the moment, we're just going to carry on, you know, banging out some tunes and kind of keep developing our sound. I think it's come a long way from the first effort 10 years ago was, like I said, was very much an experiment in actually recording with our own, you know, without using anyone else, basically kind of homegrown recording. And I think we've come a long way since then. So it's, the ideas are starting to flow a lot freer, we're gonna start banging out this next record pretty soon. I hope we do get to play. We'd have to put together a band and, you know, figure out how to play certain things that we came up with from the atmosphere, you know, but that's always fun too, you know. You can make the live thing a completely different experience.
The album Peach Giving Birth to a Stone, that is extraordinarily collectible on vinyl. Any ideas of what that kind of goes for these days?
I don't actually. I know that we re-released it. Adam did new artwork for it. So we had an original album came out in, I guess, 1992 or something like that.
94, I think. Yeah.
Oh, 94. Okay. And then when I moved to America and joined Tool, our record label at the time, one of the guys working at the label really, really liked it. And he said, we should put this out again. You know, and I was kind of like just fully immersed in my new life with Tool. So it was a bit weird to go backwards, but I have no idea how many they produced the second time or what's, I mean, you know, I would imagine the first one's pretty collectible, the first cover.
Yeah. I don't think it was re-released on vinyl. So
okay. It was just CD.
Yeah. The 94 vinyl is the only one, at least that I'm aware of, but that's a few hundred bucks if you could find one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I got one.
Oh, good. All right. Well, cool. Justin gets to eat today. All right.
Insurance policy. Yeah. You're right. I forgot they didn't release that on vinyl. So yeah, that would make it pretty rare indeed.
Now you moved to LA. Did you hear of the opportunity with Tool? Did they approach you? Was it an audition process? How did you end up entering into that world?
Well, basically we had a mutual friend. Again, it was through sort of my brother's foray into the record industry. He had a friend in LA who is the guy that ended up signing Tool. So he was working for Zoo, I guess was the label. And Matt Marshall, he signed Tool. So my brother and I were basically the first people to get the demo tape in England. Well, you know, he was pursuing them. A few people were after them, I think. And Matt sent us the Tool demo with the wrench on it, the little cassette tape. So that's the first time I heard them. Absolutely was blown away. But then we got to meet them just through that same mutual friend. You know, we got to go see them play and then, you know, became friends over a few years. They supported my band a little bit. You know, they put us on the venue, on the bill with them when they came to London so we could play somewhere other than a toilet. And then basically in the end, I had no idea, you know, that they, you know, were sort of valued my bass playing to that degree. But when they were looking for a bass player, they included me in the auditions. You know, there were many people, but they gave me that opportunity. And I just, you know, at first reluctantly, it was a bit of a scary step to take to move out, you know, move out to America. But I, with a push from my family and friends, I went out there and Bob's your uncle. You know? But I mean, it was just literally they gave me the chance to audition. That was really it. And several other people, many people, maybe 10 other people did as well. So they just, they appreciated the, they were really looking for someone that actually wrote music, that was a composer as well as a player. And, I came out, the idea was you come out with some ideas as well as learning, obviously, their songs, showing that you could play the songs. But they were interested in moving forward with the new person. So that was really what turned the tables.
Right. And the way that you create music with Tool, the three of you, Danny, Adam, you get together, you put together these ideas and let them percolate for months and months, really before even giving Maynard a glimpse of it. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, what you know, it's changed over the years. I think, you know, when bands start out and especially when you're younger and you just kind of go with what comes first, you're a little more spontaneous. And because you've never really had an idea of what you're supposed to be, your creation is already exciting, you know, so you come up with stuff a little more instantaneously. But as you go on, you kind of labor over it. Maybe you start to take it a bit more seriously and you start to explore a bit. You have the luxury of time and you know, you're getting paid now, so you can take a bit more time to be more experimental. But with Maynard, what really happened was we started to take our time so much that we'd start sending him something And he, I think he's always been very much like that still to this day. He kind of reacts with an idea and he sticks to it. And he goes with his initial instinct. But we would send him something, he'd react, and then we go, no, we've changed that now. And, you know, kind of, and it would get very frustrating for him, you know, to the point where, you know, we were like, well, we're not doing that anymore, so that's not going to work. And he's already committed emotionally an idea, you know, and words and thoughts, which is different than music. You know, I think it's like a little more emotional. So we sort of had to get through that difficult period and basically understand each other a bit better and just try and come up with a better system. And we agreed to, you know, wait until we were really sure about something before we shared it with him. You know, that gave him time to go do other things. So that's, you know, it was fine. But that's really how that process came about.
Right. You know? Is it often the case where you hear the lyrics once they're pretty much completed? The lyrics doesn't sound like it's collaborative like the music is. So you kind of feed those tapes into Maynard and then you get back what is probably three quarters of a completed thought of the lyrics?
Pretty much. I mean, it's strange, but I mean, there's certainly adjustments that are made, you know, because I think with lyrics, anyone that's really serious about it, I mean, it's a piece of poetry and it has to follow its thought. So you can't always mess with that too much, but we can adjust the music or we can make suggestions to, you know, take a little break here or, you know, tweak it around a bit. But yeah, basically over the last probably 2.5-3 albums, it's been that way where we've come up with musical pieces and then he's kind of laid his idea on top of that, with small adjustments, you know?
Right.
Okay. Which is, it's not, you know, not what everybody does, but it works for us, you know?
Well, I mean, it to me, it feels like it's a wonderful formula because the lyrics that come out are, like you say, poetry, and it's a completed thought. It's not, there's not rhymes that are shoehorned in here and there.
Yeah. It'll give, you know, when we actually recorded it, we'll obviously have heard all the lyrics by this point. We'll have played the songs together before we go into the studio. But you can really embellish then at that point, you know, little guitar licks that highlight a certain word or a feeling. And you can kind of like, you know, marry the two together at that point when you record it.
In this age of audio leaks and just people being able to get files and they could be around the world in a matter of hours, how difficult is it to control the audio of Tool before things are ready to release?
Yeah, I don't know. We've done really well at it. I think I think the time before it got leaked a little early, but we've also done things like release fake albums and fake names and kind of spread them out to get, you know, so that people go on a bit of a wild goose chase and get distracted by that, which is, you know, just that's an idea.
But part of what I think a lot of people really love about Tool is the cheekiness. Now, that's not a word that's used in the U.S. that much, but from England and Australia, the cheekiness, the, you know, the sarcasm, the playfulness in there. One of the things that is really interesting, in 10,000 Days, there are three songs that fold together to create a fourth track. How did that concept come together?
Musically, you know, we had an idea that kind of stretched out to those limits, you know, so we kind of isolated different ideas and made more than just the one song out of it. I mean, it's really, you know, like a almost like a classical piece, I guess, where you can hear elements of the first piece in the last piece and vice versa. But, you know, we're like, whoa, you know what? We got three songs in there. That's like three tracks on the album. So it kind of works both ways, you know. We got to be quite self-indulgent and do this massive long, you know, symphony almost. But also you can cut it up and have it as kind of movements, you know, where each track can be considered in its own right as well. So, yeah, it was just part of the creative process, really.
it went along beautifully with the biopic concept of the album, with the glasses and the multiple views and things like that. So
yeah, just kind of, you know, keeps everything open-ended, I guess.
With the mixes, and again, most of Tool's is these days, you know, available on streaming, with the exception of Salival, the live album. It seems to be a bit of almost a forgotten piece of the band's history. It's not on streaming services or anything like that. Any idea why that is?
I don't know why that is, actually. I'm going to have to look into that. But we really enjoyed putting that together. I mean, it's got a lot of different stuff on it, different versions, and kind of stands nicely on its own, I think. And I'm surprised it's not. I don't know. It's probably some contractual thing, you know. But I'll have to look into it. I'll see what I can do.
Yeah. Yeah, get back to me, Justin, please.
I will. Okay. Get on vinyl as well, for God's sake.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, while we're doing that. Well, yeah, we know that the Tool stuff is going to come on vinyl. We don't know when. I'm hoping that my hearing is still somewhat decent when that comes out. And I know it's also going to be, we also know it's going to be special. It's not going to be just, oh, here's a double record of Anima, you know. There's going to be some deluxe packaging or something like that. But God, we hope to definitely see that sooner than later. So in terms of Empty Void, you've got part two coming up. You've got some tours with Tool coming together. Have you guys started the writing process for the follow-up of Fear Inoculum?
We have. We've got many ideas cooking. And we haven't recorded anything yet, but we're quite busy until after the spring of next year touring. So once that's done, we're going to get back in the studio and knuckle down and put some of it together. We've already had a few pretty decent sessions of writing. So we've got all the, you know, we've got the ingredients in place. We've just got to really bang it out and you know, spend that time when we're not touring.
Are there things that are recorded that haven't been released, like almost outtakes, things that wasn't good enough for the album, but maybe for some future use?
Yeah, I mean, tons from the last album. You know, we have tons of ideas, but not recorded to the standard we'd put on an album.
Right.
Just kind of, I'd say, lots of demoed stuff. And then, you know, just tons of ideas in the, you know, just kind of stored away.
All right. Well, Justin, you know, again, thank you so much for spending some time with us here and being patient with the Record Nerd questions. And again, I want to point people towards MT Void. It's out November 10th. Matters Not, part one. There's vinyl available from Lobel Orning. I'll put the links in this episode page. There's also limited vinyl from Revolver and Brooklyn Vegan. Also, you can catch Justin and the boys from Tool on tour all over North America. One thing that I love about seeing a Tool show is that there's a no camera policy, at least for most of the show.
Yep.
So you don't spend the entire show kind of looking through the phone of the person in front of you. You can actually experience it. Again, Tool doing things different. And I always think raising the bar. Again, Justin, thanks so much for coming on the Vinyl Guide, and be well, mate.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Ah, there we go, Mr. Justin Chancellor of Empty Void and Tool. Don't forget, there's some tracks of Empty Void available on streaming right now. You can go and enjoy. Of course, you can get the record at lobelorning.com. Don't forget, there's an extended version of this interview only available to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now. It's extended, it's commercial-free, it's high resolution, and you help me buy a beer and burrito for my troubles. That's patreon.com/vinylguide, and thank you so much in advance for your support. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Share them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, throw them in the Reddit forums or the Facebook groups. Make sure your record nerd and music friends know all about the Vinyl Guide podcast. That is so appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.